counsel from two different people. He got some counsel from Ahithophel, who had turned against David and had given his allegiance to Absalom. And then he got some counsel from a fellow named Hushai, who actually was one of David's friends that was there really just to be a spy. But when he got Ahithophel's counsel, you see in verse 4 it says that the saying pleased Absalom well and all the elders of Israel. But for some reason he wasn't content with that counsel. So he asked Hushai for his counsel, and Hushai gave different counsel from Ahithophel's. And they wound up taking Hushai's counsel. And his counsel was that they gather all of the people from Dan to Beersheba, and Absalom lead them out in an effort to overcome David and his followers and completely wipe them out. That's what he counseled. And, of course, he's David's friend, so he's doing that hopefully to get Absalom out from the city and so that somebody could take care of Absalom where he wouldn't be a problem anymore. And we'll find that that does, in fact, take place. But Absalom and the people decided to follow Hushai's counsel. We saw that Ahithophel was so put out about it, so bothered that they didn't take his counsel, that he went home, set his house in order, and hanged himself, it says in verse 23. And then verse 24, we saw where David came to this place called Mahanaim. And you see at the end of that verse that Absalom is, in fact, going out with the people. He passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. They're pursuing David. And I misspoke on Wednesday night when I was teaching. In verse 25, I said David made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab. It's actually Absalom who made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab. Joab was David's main military leader, and Joab was with David. So Absalom has to come up with his own military leader, his main man, if you will, and he chooses a fellow by the name of Amasa to be in the stead of Joab. And we saw on Wednesday night that this turned out to be Joab's cousin. So he's in Joab's family. He's a relative. And evidently that whole family there were just, they were good in military things, evidently. We've seen it with Joab and his brothers. And then you see even now he has a cousin that Absalom had enough confidence in that he picked him to be his main military leader. So apparently that whole family was a military family and acquainted with things of that nature. But it says in verse 26, so Israel and Absalom pitched in the land of Gilead. So they come to this particular place and they set up camp there. In verse 27, when we pick up, it says, and it came to pass when David was come to Mahanaim that Shobai, the son of Nahash of Rabbah of the children of Ammon, that's one person, this fellow named Nahash, and Machir, the son of Amiel of Lodibar, that's another person, Barzillai, the Gileadite of Rogalim. And I hope and pray I'm saying all that right. that's some of them words you just do the best you can with. Yeah. But these three people come to David. The one in the middle, this Maker, the son of Amiel of Lodibar, he has been referenced early on back in chapter 9. If you remember, David wanted somebody from the house of Saul that he could show kindness to for Jonathan's sake because of that covenant that he and Jonathan made. And he was told by Ziba about a son of Jonathan's named Mephibosheth. Y'all remember him? Well, Mephibosheth at the time was living where? Lodibar is where he was living. And it turns out he was living in the house of this fellow right here. And you can see that if you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 9 and verse number 4. So while Mephibosheth lived in Lodibar, he lived with that fellow right there, that second one that's mentioned. This Barzillai, the Gileadite of Rogalim, we'll read more about him later on. Turns out he was an old man. He was well up in years at this point in time, but he was loyal. He was very loyal and faithful to David. But these three get together. In verse 28 and 29, you see that they bring some resources to David and his men. They brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched corn and beans and lentils and parched pulps and honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kind. Any of y'all hungry yet? Making me hungry. Now, some of that stuff I'm not familiar with. I looked up the definition to some of it, but as far as being in my diet, I've never had lentils. Have any of y'all ever eaten lentils? You have? Anybody else eaten lentils before? You have? Explain it to me. What is it? That's the definition, was some kind of bean type thing. That's not real common in our culture, is it? Okay. All right. They wasn't purple hull peas, was it, brother? I hear you. All right. Yeah, that's why we don't know anything about them right there, brother. Lentils, parched pulse. Pulse, by definition, is some type of edible seed. And here it says it's been parched. I ain't never had any parched pulse. I've eaten a lot of parched peanuts in my life, but not parched pulse. Well, this was probably common food for these people, that area of the world. Honey, I know about that. I love honey. Butter, hey, who doesn't like butter? Butter's, I don't know how healthy it is for you, but it sure does make biscuits taste a lot better, doesn't it? Honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kine. A kine is a cow, so it's not goat cheese, it's cow cheese, in other words. Cheese of kine. How many of you like cheese? I love it. I love cheese. It's good. But they brought all this stuff for David and for the people that were with him to eat. For they said the people is hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. And that certainly was the case. But you again see some of this loyalty that I talked about when we first started this study here of David being on the run from Absalom. You see that there were people that defected and turned their back on David. But all the way through you see people that remain faithful. They remain loyal. And not just loyal from a distance. Okay, and there is a difference in being loyal from a distance and actually demonstrating your loyalty to someone. It's one thing for me to say, well, such and such is my friend, and I support them. But it's a whole other ball game when I say such and such is my friend and I support them, and then I do something to show my faithfulness and my loyalty to that person. That's kind of taking it to another level, and really that proves your loyalty. I just kind of feel like until you do something to demonstrate it, your words really don't matter all that much. And you can say that about just any area of our life, really. It's easy to talk, right? It's easy to talk a big game and say where we stand and who we support and who we're for and that kind of business. But oftentimes, that's just lip service. That's just somebody talking, you know. What really, the proof in the pudding is when somebody demonstrates it, when they step up and they do things, they make sacrifices, they take chances, they put their life on the line, they put themselves in jeopardy for another person. Well, that's something you see through this story here. There were people who actually, they didn't just say from a distance, "I support David." They actually did some things to show that they supported David, to prove that they were on his side. And you got three guys here who did that. They get together, they pool their resources, and they bring a whole bunch of good stuff out to David and his men so that they can have the nourishment that they need. And that shows me their loyalty and their fidelity to David. But now we come to chapter 18, and this is the chapter when we find that the rubber actually meets the road. There is a battle between the followers of Absalom and the followers of David. And we're going to see how all of that plays itself out in this chapter here. Verse 1 says, "And David numbered the people that were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them." Now that does show you that David had quite a following here. It's a little different, quite a bit different, in fact, than it was when he was on the run from Saul. Because he's on the run from Saul, he really didn't have but about 600 fighting men that was with him. Now, there were some others, but I'm talking about fighting men. He had about 600. Here, he's got a lot larger group of people, soldiers that are with him. Hundreds and thousands is what you see here. He set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. So what it means is he divides out his people and he sets people in charge of these different groups that he has divided out. Look at verse 2. It gives explanation. And David sent forth a third part of the people under the hand of Joab and a third part under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother. Those are two people that you should at least at this point be familiar with, because we've talked about them several times. They had a third brother, y'all remember. We've talked about him. Y'all remember that other brother? This is my brother Darrell, and this is my other brother Darrell, you know. Well, he had a third brother, Asahel was his name, got killed by Abner. Y'all remember that? Y'all just don't seem real confident that y'all remember that. But anyway, these two are given a third, but then here's this other fella and a third part under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. Now, this fella has been mentioned before also. He was the one that came from Gath. He was an exile, you remember, and brought about 600 men with him, and they came to where David was. Well, that's this fella. Even though he came from Gath, which y'all remember who lived in Gath, right? That's the Philistines. Matter of fact, that's where Goliath was from. Remember the big giant man? He was Goliath of Gath, is what the Bible says. So that's where that big fella come from. But for whatever reason, Ittai and some men leave there, and they come to David. And evidently, David had confidence in his military ability, his ability to lead people into battle, because he takes him and sets him over a third part of his men. So he's got three different groups, a third under Joab, a third under Abishai, and a third under Ittai. And the king said unto the people, I will surely go forth with you myself also. He said, I'm going to go out to battle with you. I'm going to lead you. I think he's wanting to show that he's willing to go out in battle, you know, and lead the people and not just sit back and expect them to go do all the dirty work. And it also could be that he's thinking back to a time when he didn't go when he should have went. Y'all remember that? That time when kings go forth to battle, but David decided to stay home and take a nap on his roof. And y'all remember that's what got this whole mess started right here. So maybe he's thinking back to, hey, that didn't work out so well last time, so I believe this time I'll go, or at least I'll offer to go. And when he offers, he's got every intention to go. And David was not a coward. He had already proved his ability to lead and to fight, just in what he did with Goliath and what he did when he was over Saul's army. He had already proved that. No question. Even before he showed up and fought Goliath, you remember, he killed a lion and a bear with his bare hands. So we're not talking about a coward, some weak-kneed, spaghetti-spined person that wants everybody else to do the fighting for him. David was willing to go. But I just have to believe that in the back of his mind, when he says, I will go with you, he's thinking back to that time when he knew he should have went, but he didn't go. Which shows me that David perhaps learned a lesson there, that you don't shirk your responsibility, that you do what you're supposed to do, because when you don't do what you're supposed to do, it can create problems. It can lead to temptation and other things that can get you in a mess. It's good to see that he's learned that. I fear that many times in our lives, we just repeat things. We repeat mistakes. We just do it over and over again. For whatever reason, we don't seem to learn. We do something, we make bad choices, bad decisions. We get ourselves in a mess. We get through that by God's grace. And then another opportunity shows itself on down the road for us to do the right thing. And for whatever reason, we don't learn. Some people just don't learn. They just keep doing the same stuff over and over again, just making the same mistakes. It looks to me like David had learned, so he's willing to go. Verse 3, the people, you see, did not want him to go. And again, it didn't have anything with their believing he wasn't an effective leader. It didn't have anything to do with that. They wanted to make sure David was safe. They knew he was the main man and that he's the one that Absalom and his people would be after more than anybody. And they loved David. They did not want him to be killed. So you see verse 3, the people answered, "Thou shalt not go forth." And as you read on, we'll see that David wound up not going with them. But this, the difference here from what we were just talking about is back there it said it was a time when the kings went forth to battle, right? It specifically said that. Well, this wasn't that. This is a different situation here. So it was all right that David listened to the people. He chose not to go. But the people didn't want him to go. They say, "For if we flee away, they will not care for us." That is, if we start running, they're not going to keep following after us. They're going to be after you because you're the one they want most of all. "Neither if half of us die will they care for us." Doesn't matter. They still, you're the priority. "But now thou art worth 10,000 of us." Now that shows you how much respect they had for David, the love they had for him, what they thought about him. They said, "You're worth 10,000 of us. Just you, by yourself. You put 10,000 of us together, you're worth that to us." See? So that shows you the value they placed on David as a leader, as their king, as a person. "Therefore now it is better that thou succor us out of the city." That succor is a word that means to assist or help in distress, to relieve. They're saying, "Hey, you just stay here in the city, you'll be safer here, and you can help us from where you are. If we need help, if we need some kind of relief, you can provide that for us out of the city." "And the king said unto them, what seemeth you best I will do." He concedes. If that's what you think we need to do in this situation, I'll do it. Which to me, this shows a really good quality that needs to be found in any person that desires to be a leader. David is willing to listen to his people and consent to what they suggest for him in this situation. That is a quality that needs to be in any person in any position in leadership, whether it be spiritual or otherwise. I have seen people who get a position and suddenly they think they know everything and it goes to their head and they become arrogant and conceited and they don't want to listen to anybody. It's just my way or the highway kind of attitude, sort of a dictator rule with an iron fist. I don't care what anybody says. We're going to do it the way I want to, and that sort of attitude. To me, that's somebody that's not qualified to be a leader. When your pride and ego is always standing in the way and you're not willing to at least listen to the advice and counsel of other people, you're not fit to be a leader as far as I'm concerned. Because reality is, God gives the people that are under you or that you're over, gives them wisdom, doesn't he? He gives them abilities and things that they are able to do and know how to do. And many times, they have knowledge of things that the person over them doesn't have knowledge of. And it's quite foolish of a person who has no experience in an area and has no knowledge in an area to not listen to somebody who does have experience in that. To me, I think about church situation because I'm a preacher, so naturally that's where my mind's going to go. But I've met some preachers who they just, you know, "We're going to do it like I want to around here." They don't ever want to listen to anything that anybody in the congregation has to say. They don't want to take their advice or counsel. It's just, you know, "We're going to do it the way I want to." I think that's silly and ridiculous. There are people all in this congregation, and really in any congregation, who have wisdom and abilities I do not possess. I just don't. And it would be foolish of me if a situation came up, as it always does, where somebody in the church, we had a situation and somebody in the church knew something about that, and I didn't. And they're trying to say, now, Brother Keith, I think this is a good idea. This is how we need to handle this. This is how we can fix this problem. I'm like, well, I don't care what you think. We're going to do it the way I want to around here. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. It makes no sense. And to me, a person like that is not qualified to be a leader. If you are not humble enough to listen to the counsel and advice of others, you're not fit to be a leader. That's the way I feel about it. And David here demonstrates that he is willing to listen to the advice of his people. He says in the verse, what seemeth you best, I will do. That'd be like me, you know, somebody, say my car tears up, you know, and this is what I do know. I am not a mechanic, okay? I can tear a car up, but I can't fix a car. And somebody be in there who knows how to fix the problem. But my attitude is, look, you know, I don't need your advice. I don't need to hear what you got to say. I'll take care of this on my own. Well, that's a fool that talks that way. I mean, that's just sheer idiocy is what that is. I should be willing to listen to that person who has experience and take their advice, because if I don't, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to make the situation worse. I'm not going to make it better. I'm going to make it worse. So you need to be willing to listen. The Bible talks about an old and foolish king that will no longer be admonished. You get to that point in your life where you're so pig-headed and arrogant and prideful that you think you know it all and you ain't going to listen to nobody else. You're just headed for trouble, okay? You're headed for trouble. And you're going to lead other people into trouble. But David says, what seems best, that's what I'll do. And the king stood by the gate side, and all the people came out by hundreds and by thousands. There's a big group here, and he's got them divided up, three groups with these three men over them. And look at this now, verse 5. The king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, he commanded them. He did not suggest to them. He commanded them as their king, deal gently for my sake with the young man, even with Absalom. David doesn't agree with what's going on here with Absalom. Obviously, Absalom's completely wrong. But at the end of the day, that's still his son, isn't it? And he loves him. And even though he's done wrong, completely wrong, he still doesn't want any harm to come to his son. That's just how that is. You know, when you have kids, that's just the way that is. And he tells them specifically, commands them, and he tells Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, why does he tell them three? Because they're in charge of those different groups. See, you had the king, but then he had delegated some authority to those three men, and those three men had some authority. They were over other people. It's like a chain of command type thing. David's a king, then he had other people that he had given authority to be over these people, and they were under them. They were responsible, and they should go to those people and say, this is what the king said, and this is how we are to deal with Absalom, and make it very clear. So they were to do what the king said and make sure their men did what the king said. It says at the end of verse 5, and all the people heard when the king gave all the captains charge concerning Absalom. So all the people heard what was said. Nobody's in the dark about this. Everybody knows exactly what the king expects when it comes to his son Absalom. Everybody understands that. Verse 6, so the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was in the wood of Ephraim. Ephraim was part of the inheritance. You know, they had their part in the inheritance. And this battle unfolds in the wood of Ephraim. So wooded areas, the idea. Where the people of Israel were slain before the servants of David. And there was a great slaughter that day of 20,000 men. 20,000 people that followed Absalom died that day. David and his men obviously are winning the battle, okay? And 20,000 men, 20,000 good men, and I don't necessarily mean good in the sense that they were moral, upstanding people, because they have followed a fellow who's rebelling against his daddy, which shows a lack on their part. But I mean good people in the sense that they were military people and folk that could have helped out in David's kingdom, good people. And when I read that and you read stories like that in the Bible, what comes to my mind is that this didn't have to happen. 20,000 people died that day, and not one of them had to die that day. Have you ever thought about, just sat and thought about the countless lives that are lost that don't have to be lost? Every day in this country. That's just in our country. I'm not talking about all around the world, but just in our country on a daily basis. The countless lives, people that die that didn't have to die that day. Didn't have to. And that's this situation. None of this stuff had to happen. Had David not done what he did, I don't think this would have happened. And had Absalom not done what he did, it wouldn't have happened. You got people making bad decisions and bad choices all the way through here, and people get hurt, and lives are lost. People die that didn't have to die. And there's been many a person that went to an early grave. There's no doubt about it. The Bible says the years of the wicked shall be shortened, but he that feareth the Lord shall prolong his days. The years of the wicked shall be shortened. There's been many a person that died really before they needed to die. Things happen. When people do wrong, lives are affected. Bad things happen. People die. People get hurt. All kinds of stuff happen. Just think about the people through the years that have died because they went off and got drunk and they had an accident. Did that have to happen? No. Now, I realize you can get killed in an accident and be sober as a judge. I know that. But I'm telling you right now, when you get drunk and get behind the wheel of a vehicle, you greatly increase the odds you're going to kill yourself or somebody else. That's a fact of life, friend. Think about the countless lives, thousands upon thousands of people across the United States right now that are hooked on drugs and they've destroyed their life. Many of them died. Did that have to happen? No. Think of the homes that have been busted up because one spouse decided they wanted to satisfy their flesh and get out, get involved with somebody else. That have to happen? No. Stuff happens all the time. What I'm saying, bad things happen all the time that don't have to happen. If we could just do like we're supposed to do, we could eliminate a whole lot of the death and problems that you see going on. But because we won't do right. And what's crazy about it is, no matter what, we're going to have tribulation in this life, right? That's what the Bible teaches. I don't think we need to add to that. But we're going to get enough of that stuff to deal with without adding to it by making foolish, bad decisions, doing things we don't need to do. That just brings more and more heartache and harm and death into our lives. So much stuff. I think about my own life and things that happened in the past that never would have happened, had I not made the choices that I made. Wouldn't have happened. And this is that situation right here. 20,000. That's a lot of folks, isn't it? 20,000 people died in a day. That's a lot of people died. And not one of them had to die. Not one. Verse 8, for the battle was there scattered over the face of all the country, all that country there where they're at. Not like over the whole entire land, but over that place where they're at. Over the face of all the country. And the wood, remember this is in the wood of Ephraim, the wood devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. So there was some bad stuff in them woods there. And a lot of these people, as they're out there fighting, are getting killed by something in the wood. Now, what was some of the stuff there? Well, I don't know everything that was there, but if you look down at verse 17, you see one thing that was there. Verse 17 says, "And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood." What a great pit is, that's a big old hole. So that's in the wood. Evidently, there was a lot of these big holes and pits and different stuff out there, and as the people are fighting, they're falling into these things, different stuff like that's happening. And it winds up, according to verse 8, that more people died from that stuff there in the wood than actually with the sword. That's what it says in verse number 8. Now, verse 9, we're going to stop here. "And Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away." Now, a couple of things that I don't necessarily understand. I don't understand why he's on a mule, first of all, because mules really weren't for battle. Most of the time when people went out to battle, what they ride? A horse, okay? But for whatever reason, he's on a mule here. And this mule he's riding goes up under the thick boughs of a great oak, and his head got caught in the oak. Why would his head get caught in the oak? Y'all remember that a couple chapters back about how one time a year he'd cut his hair? He let it grow all year long, so evidently he had real long, thick hair. If there was ever a verse in the Bible that should encourage men not to have long hair, this is it, isn't it? I mean, really. Some of us don't have to worry about that, do we, Brother Gene? Don't have to worry about your hair getting hung in an oak tree. When you out cutting the grass, you ain't got to worry about that. But his hair gets caught in all those thick boughs, and he's hung there. He can't get loose. And his mule just keeps on going, just walks out from under him. So he's hanging there, just dangling there literally in an oak tree. And we're going to stop here, and we'll finish up looking at this story tonight. And we'll see how things play out with Absalom. Any questions about what we looked at today? Any questions?